All of this, furthermore, is just second nature to the people now in power, to the Bush planners. Remember, they're mostly recycled Reaganites. They come from the Reagan-Bush administration 20 years ago, and they're following pretty much the same routine, if you look at it, including the war on terror, which was not declared on September 11th, but it was declared 20 years earlier by the same people with the same rhetoric and very much many of the same people in leading positions. We know what happened then. At least we should. One example was just given, Archbishop Romero, the decade of the 1980s, that horrifying decade, opened with his assassination. Had become a voice for the voiceless, as he was called by his associates. He was assassinated by elite units closely connected to and supported by the United States, and that just set off a decade of horror in Central America and elsewhere, the Middle East, Africa, all under the huge amount of horrifying international terrorism and destruction, all under the pretext of a war on terror by the same people. So you want to have, elementary sanity dictates that if we want to learn about what's going on now, we would look at what happened then. But that topic is also under a ban, like our terrorism generally. You can check the vast literature on the war on terror since it was redeclared by the same people on September 11th, and you can easily determine how much this highly relevant very recent history has been discussed. Well, put that aside. Clearly that's all of this is, as I say, second nature to these guys. They did the same thing 20 years ago. You're too young to recall, but, you know, your parents do, that 20 years ago there was another brave cowboy leader in the White House. He was cringing in fear in the White House, surrounded by tanks to protect him from Libyan hitmen who were roaming the streets of Washington. A few years later, he was wailing about how Gaddafi wants to expel America from the world, no less, and warning that the Nicaraguan army is only 2 days marching time from Texas. So we have to huddle in fear. And they're planning to carry out, to conquer the hemisphere, following a script from Mein Kampf. That's George Shultz. He was the administration moderate, the Colin Powell of the day. And a national emergency was called in the United States because of the threat to our security and existence posed by the government of Nicaragua. So if you think we're in trouble now with Saddam Hussein, remember it's been a lot worse in the recent past. And it went on and on, Hispanic narco-traffickers, you know, almost anything you can think of. At that time, frightened Americans were an object of considerable wonder in the world, and not ridicule sometimes. And the government inspired plenty of fear. A huge anti-nuclear movement developed in Europe, partly in fear of Reaganite fanaticism. And that's understandable, and now that the same people are back again, now without any deterrent, there's even greater fear. So it's not surprising that much of the world is, regards the U.S. as a menace to itself and to mankind. Well, let's go back to, nor is it surprising that they're following the same policies. That only makes sense. So back to Ami Ayalon and how to reduce terror if we're interested, namely address the underlying grievances. He, of course, was speaking of Israel-Palestine, where the only solution of the problem of terror is to offer an honorable solution to Palestinians respecting their right of self-determination. Well, that that happens to be the conclusion of the head of the Israeli secret police that runs the territories, but I was quoting somebody else, namely one of his predecessors, Yehoshafat Harkabi, who was the head of Israeli military intelligence and a leading Arabist, and that was 20 years ago. That was after another shocking outburst of army and settler violence in the occupied territories. And bear in mind that that was at a time when Israel retained its immunity from any retaliation from within the territories to the brutal and harsh practices it was conducting there, and also to its program of stealing land and resources. All of this is thanks to crucial U.S. support all the way through, as it is today. Otherwise, it's totally impossible. That immunity from retaliation lasted until quite recently, so therefore the violence and oppression and atrocities were considered quite unproblematic by elite American opinion. That brings us back to the definition of terror. It's only what they do to us. It's not what they do to we do to them, which is typically far worse, just for reasons of the amount of force available. But it's unproblematic for those who give patriotism a bad name. Terrorism is often called a weapon of the weak. That's just not true. Like most weapons, it's a weapon of the strong primarily, except they don't call it terror. They call it counterterror or something like that. Well, the observations of Ayalon and Harkavy, they generalize in quite obvious ways. And in serious scholarship, there's just no question about it. It's recognized, quoting now, that unless the social, political, and economic conditions that spawned Al-Qaeda and other associated groups are addressed, the United States and its allies will continue to be targeted by terrorists. Same point. Want to reduce terrorism, address the underlying grievances. It's true whether it's the IRA or radical Islamists or whoever you like. It's a truism. It's only intellectuals who are posturing before the galleries who sink to such mindless absurdities as the claim that explanation is justification, or who claim that whatever is going on, it's all their fault. We don't play any role by definition because we're so good or even magnificent. That's the common stance of the powerful right through the ages. Nothing new here. We're just replaying the same ugly and disgraceful record. In fact, you have to insist on this so strongly that even the government record, the internal U.S. government record at the very highest levels, has to be rigorously suppressed, and is. You can check again. So take George Bush's pathetic question, why do they hate us? Answer, because we're so good. But the question was, he's not the first person to have asked the question, and anyone who wants to understand these issues should know that. The question was asked long ago, 45 years before, by President Eisenhower in 1958. This is an internal discussion, but it's been public for years. I wrote about it 10 years ago when it was declassified. In 1958, Eisenhower discussed with his staff what he called the campaign of hatred against us by the people in the Arab world. And the staff, the National Security Council, highest planning body, gave the reasons. The reasons are a recognition in that region that the United States supports brutal and repressive governments and blocks democracy and development, and we do it because of our interest in controlling the oil resources of the region. That continues right into the present. Now we don't have secret documents, but we have public investigations, and they lead the same results, exacerbated by particular policies. All of this, incidentally, has absolutely nothing to do with hating America. These are mostly people who like Americans, who greatly admire American freedom and democracy, who participate in, these are managers of multinational corporations, no problem with what's called globalization or any of that stuff. What they hate is U.S. government policies that block democracy and development and support brutal and repressive regimes in order to ensure control over the resources of the region. And that goes on right up to the present. There's a wave of anger in Pakistan, for example, over U.S. support for harsh military regime, which is clearly undermining democracy. The same is true in Central Asia, and it's all over Egypt, all over the place. You have to be blind not to see it, perfectly blind, purposely blind, because it's not hidden. The resources of the region are not a joke either. Back in the 1940s, in 1945, the State Department described the resources of the Persian Gulf as a stupendous source of strategic power and the greatest, one of the greatest material prizes in world history. It's not a small thing. The U.S. was, of course, committed immediately after the war to taking control of that stupendous resource and material prize, and did so. The problem is not access. It's important to understand. It's control. The material prize yields a huge flow of wealth to the United States in various ways, and the strategic power translates into an instrument of world control. Now, that's quite critical for understanding U.S. goals in Iraq. As the second largest oil reserves in the world, second to Saudi Arabia, access has never been a problem, and it isn't a problem now. It's control. There's a lot of misunderstanding about that, and it's important to think it through carefully. Well, let me return to the expectations of the powerful. Luckily for us, they tell us about it. An important public document produced about 2 years ago by the, almost 3 years ago by the National Intelligence Council, that's the collection of the highest intelligence agencies with along with academic specialists and others, they have a publication called Global Trends 2015. So what do they expect for the next 15 years? Here's the main prediction. What they call globalization will continue on course. Its evolution will be rocky with increasing financial volatility and a widening economic divide. Just think about that for a minute. According to, theoretically, globalization is supposed to lead to convergence, integrated market with a single price and wage. But they're predicting the opposite, a widening economic divide. That means less globalization in the technical sense, but more in the doctrinally preferred sense. That is, the people who matter will do just fine, and the rest sort of not our department. More financial volatility means slower growth, harming mainly the poor. Actually, that lifts the veil on another aspect of foreign policy, a rather striking feature for the past 25 years or so, what's called neoliberal policy or sometimes globalization. It's been accompanied this period by a marked deterioration in standard economic measures right across the board, growth of the economy, productivity, investment, even trade, and stagnation for most of the population, but a huge concentration of wealth. That's sharply true in the richest country in the world, us, but it's pretty general for the countries that follow the rules. Those who didn't made out much better. It's rather striking that the countries that followed the rules most rigorously, like Latin America, suffered the most, while those that ignored them, like East Asia, managed to escape the general decline. Well, there's a lot more to say about this, including the tremendous attack on democracy that all this involves. We're seeing it right now in Brazil, but there's no time for that. The conclusion of the powerful is that we should extend and intensify the global policies that have had these consequences. Happens to be giving rise to major popular struggles throughout the world. That's some of the most important developments going on now, but again, have to put it aside. Well, let's return to the expectations. What are going to be the effects of the widening economic divide? Here's the National Intelligence Council. As globalization proceeds, deepening economic stagnation will foster political